The TCG Design Theory Podcast is part of the Booster Pack Network. For more TCG-related content, visit theboosterpacknetwork.com. Hosting for this show is sponsored by Category 1 Games, the go-to shop for all of your classic TCG needs. Find your favorites or discover something new at category1games.com. All right, hey everybody, welcome to the TCG Design Theory Podcast. My name is Jay, and today I have Hunter Angel, who is the creator of the Nostalgics TCG. And here today, he's going to talk to me about how to build a community and some of the steps you can take to get people involved in your game. So Hunter, how are you doing?
Doing awesome. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to this.
Absolutely. And thanks for coming on. And so before we get started, can we or can you kind of go into a little bit about yourself and how, you know, you got into game design and what ultimately made you decide to create a trading card game?
Yeah, so it really started quite a long time ago, honestly. I was in a corporate job, got about as high up in the career ladder as you could before I was a lifer. And I was like, you know what, this is just kind of too bureaucratic. So I started doing like creative side jobs and just keeping that part of my brain alive. So it started with YouTube and being inspired by Pokemon unboxers like Leonhard, Unlisted Leaf. That eventually led to a video where I put a fake card in the thumbnail. That video exploded. And I used that opportunity to kind of be like, okay, wait, people like this fake card clearly. I wonder if I could make that look like a real card. So I went about using printers in my house and supplies from like, you know, a Hobby Lobby or Michael's. And I kind of scrapped together this custom Pokemon card, which people wanted then. So I was like, okay, well, how could I make more of these quicker for people? And eventually I launched a business. We started partnering with artists around the world. At some point in there, I ended up with like 50 plus artists. I was working with Jason Page, who sang the Pokemon theme song. All these Pokemon YouTubers were opening products like all over the world. And then we were outranking Pokemon and then Yu-Gi-Oh! At the time on Google for their top characters, as our arts were doing so well. And I was like, you know, this is going too well. I wonder if they're okay with this. And then the question started to enter the head, like, at what point does fan art threaten a like mainstay TCG? And I went, you know, some of these artists are truly relying on the income generated from these custom cards for their lives. And now I have a five-year-old at this point. So I was like, let's take a step back. Let's invent our own TCG and kind of curtail the custom phase and create our own custom card game. And that led to the Kickstarter. And really, honestly, the success of that was a lot of the custom card network and the players and collectors we accumulated along the way. So here we are. We just launched set two. We're working on set three.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a really interesting origin story because it's like, yeah, we're doing really well with this established IP. You know, we're doing really well with Pokemon. Let's just do our own thing. And you already had an established network of customers and artists. And I think that's, I don't think I've heard a story quite like that where someone kind of was like, well, I got this community right now. Let's go ahead and start this thing. So should be a very interesting conversation about building a community around a trading card game.
Right.
So I know that a lot of people kind of tend to do some of the same things, right? Where they kind of pursue the creative side or the creative part of them on the side. And then once they have a project, you know, then it's up to them to kind of get people involved. So from the standpoint of someone who isn't bringing some, you know, a bunch of people in from custom Pokemon cards and things like that, what are some good steps to take for a designer who's at a good place with their game and ready to share some of these ideas? What are some good first steps for them to start getting people involved in a meaningful way?
So it's something that I feel like I don't do as well anymore. I did this really well back in the custom Pokemon days, but going from just putting out a card a day and essentially changing the world, getting thousands of likes on Instagram to having your own business and your own property, I lost a bit of this. But community involvement in the regards of taking ideas for new cards. When you're making a whole TCG, it's harder to be like, okay, here's a good idea. We'll make that in 6 months. Whereas a custom card, you're just like, yeah, I'm going to do that tomorrow. You know, that sounds awesome. But fan engagement as far as like comments, ideas for series, and then like fan art contests. We've done a few of those for Nostalgics. That seems to always get people in the door. Or playtesting feedback. For us, we made like an inner circle that we call the Spartans. And they're like well-qualified hero level community members that can be trusted at an event to essentially speak the right opinion of the game and kind of portray that love and affection that as a team we have, but the average community member might not fully have. And they're like that elevated level of people. So it's really getting that inner circle that you can trust to hold your back online and really promote the spirit of the game in a good way.
Mm-hmm. And so from, you know, like you said, from the perspective of building a community with something that you can produce immediately versus something that is like, hey, this may be a thing down the road. You know, saying you were, you know, let's say you were starting from scratch and you had an idea for, you know, another game that wasn't quite fitting with the community that you have now. And you were to go to one of the platforms to, you know, start an account for that game or that, you know, idea. What would be some of those first things that you do in terms of just letting people know it exists?
So a lot of it's going to end up being collaborations. And some of the best ways that I started up was just having great work myself. So what you put out, it should be your best work, you know, kind of quality over quantity. And then once you get that facing everybody, it's finding people that maybe are a similar level or within, you know, 10, 20%, and then trying to do a collaboration post with them. It's maybe a little bit trickier now. Instagram feels like it's on the tail end of engagement right now. And everybody's kind of going Twitter or just TikTok and shorts, YouTube shorts everywhere, Instagram reels. But back when it was images, it was easier to just partner with somebody and make something together. So I would say make friends, because as cliche and cheesy as it is, it's really the friends you make along the way, because that's what gets you greater exposure, greater engagement, and just like more partners in any project you do.
Mm-hmm. And so you would say not necessarily building off of the audience of other people, but, you know, building those genuine relationships to make your project stronger, but also in the end, you know, utilize not only them, but their communities, and they can utilize the communities that you build. So if I am, you know, if I'm looking at this project that I have and I've play tested it a few times and I, you know, I'm ready to get feedback on it from other people. Do you suggest looking at that from the perspective of, hey, I need to try to find people who are more interested in playtesting? Do you find people who are just kind of interested in the game or the story? You know, because we are talking trading card games, there's a collectability, a lore, a game, you know. So which avenue do you think is more prevalent in those early stages versus, you know, playtesting versus giving people story bits versus just maybe just showing them art?
I think for us, art has always been an appeal. Playtesting was, in the beginning, a matter of locking myself in my apartment at the time for like a month. I just took a sabbatical from custom cards, and I printed out physical paper cards of the entire base set of Pokemon, Jungle, Fossil, the first like four of Yu-Gi-Oh! Because it kind of transitioned from Monsters to Magic Ruler to like Pharaoh's Servant, which was more trap cards. And then even like the Alpha set of Magic and a couple from Hearthstone. And I compared everything to see what worked. So once I had that, I knew it was a pretty good formula, because you're using the research that these companies put into their games, which is like, you know, 20 plus years on some of these, and they must be doing something right. So it's really like borrowing somebody's homework and then fusing it with everything else. And eventually you come to the most equal sum. But early steps, if you get to a playtesting part, I would say you could go one of two ways. We were creating characters at the time, but we were also creating cards, and those didn't necessarily connect quite yet. So some people got latched on to the ideas we had, and some people got latched on to the gameplay side of it. And those are very different people. So I think going to a game store and finding, you know, a Magic player or like a professional Pokemon player is always going to help you. And think of things that you maybe didn't, you know, which combos can break the game. But it's a balance of the two. As long as people are getting interested in your game, that's the end goal. And lore is kind of even aside from both of those. So it really is like collectability, playability, art look, lore, like all of it bundled into one package. You somehow have to sell every single point at once. So do what's best. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's an amazing part of it because, like with Pokemon, you know, people just go and they buy the cards of the Pokemon that they like. You know, they have no idea how to play the game, you know, and that's perfectly fine because they just want to get those cards that look awesome, or they just want to have them because they were fans of the game. But, you know, you mentioned kind of going to, you know, your local game stores and, you know, kind of utilizing communities and kind of people that you already know to kind of bring into your project. What about the different platforms? Because, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. It's like, should I make a subreddit for my game, a Facebook group, a Discord, a YouTube? Should I shoot smoke signals up in the air and see if I use them? You know, so what are some of the major differences between some of these platforms and which are some that have been the most effective for your projects?
Going back really quick, though, you mentioned people would collect their favorite Pokemon cards based on the characters that they, you know, saw in games or shows. And that really ties into the lore part, is how do you get somebody attached to a character to kind of make it their friend and make them want to collect that card. So just kind of a thing I picked out there. But without a game or these expansions to your world, people might not ever gain an attraction to a character unless you give them more reasons to connect to it. But as far as like different platforms, Insta's always been my go-to. It felt like the place where I had the most resonance, being kind of an art background myself and really partnering with other artists. Instagram was like the place to go. Sure, DeviantArt came before it, and DeviantArt will probably be here after Facebook's dead and gone in like 70 years. It doesn't seem like DeviantArt will ever die. But Instagram's just kind of a solid platform, and it seems to be evolving pretty well and taking ideas from other social medias like Snapchat and getting the stories, and then obviously like TikTok and the reels. But it seems like the hashtags have really gone down, and there's hidden parts of the algorithm that I don't think creators realize, that the more you use the app, the more it's going to recommend you to people that you're following. So if you're not actually using the app as a person, you're just using it to post, then you log off. Like you're shooting yourself in the foot, and there's these hidden elements to it and kind of like gray listed words. So if you say link in bio, it might drop your post more versus if it feels more natural. Or if you say money or a dollar sign at all, you'll get like 5% of your typical engagement because they go, nope, this is a business post. You should pay us to promote that. And it's just a lot harder to kind of walk that hallway on Instagram now. Twitter, it's got like an 8-minute lifespan every time you tweet and then it's dead. Facebook's for people bored, essentially, and I don't really see it being used for too much other than like store owners to put their shop hours on there, and like my parents, and occasionally like once every 4 months I'll post on it, and that seems to be the norm. TikTok really is where it's at, which is difficult because the amount of time that you put into an image can be really high. So the amount of time you put into a short and a long form video can, you know, obviously span from short to just like live streaming a video of you to Mr. Beast levels of quality. And that's a big jump in efforts to really get something that goes viral nowadays. But TikTok's probably where you should be and trying to get viral marketing on there. As a business, it's a little trickier because you can't use commercial sounds on Instagram if you're a business account. But TikTok seems kind of all okay with that. So starting out, I would say don't make a business account. Just keep it a personal or a creator one so you can use those catchy sounds and get more traction.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, those are a lot of good ideas for, you know, kind of not necessarily marketing, but kind of saying, you know, it's a good way to say, hey, I have this thing. People can search for it. Like you said, if you are acting like an actual person, being on these platforms and connecting with people that are like you, then naturally you are going to kind of fit into that bubble. So there's a lot of that. And I know how Instagram and TikTok work. You know, you post something and people can comment and you can respond and things like that. What about some of the more collaborative areas? So, you know, in terms of Facebook, like Facebook groups, you know, something that's just like, hey, you're part of this community group that talks about the game. It's not just, you know, hey, I'm posting when the next expansion's coming out. So things like Facebook groups, Discord, and I'll kind of throw in a little bit of Reddit there a little bit because Reddit does have a lot of good back and forth, but it is that same like post structure. So what are some of the key differences you've seen between those?
I would even possibly kick on Patreon in that group a little bit. And it's really like that, that closer engagement community. the interesting part about these is that they're closed, which means any information you put on them, people are going to have to join this thing to read that, typically. The good side of that is you get really awesome engagement. Like, people are notified right away when you have things to say. They're talking with other people, kind of getting more ingrained in the community. And Discord is our favorite right now because it's got the different like rooms that you can go in. Whereas the subreddit, you've got different posts, but they kind of scroll too fast. These have static, you know, rooms you can go in and talk about stuff. I think it's whether you have a product to put out into the world. You know, if you do, Patreon is obviously the right way to go about it. Or if you're looking for ongoing funding beyond like a Kickstarter's, you know, flash in the pan, Patreon would be it. If you're looking for dedicated rooms to kind of funnel topics of conversation, Discord, absolutely. Reddit, I haven't used myself enough, but if you've got a pretty wide audience and you want to make it wider, Reddits are far more discoverable than a Discord is. And Pinterest is surprisingly still used quite often. Even in the custom days, I would find images that we made on Pinterest all the time. So people make boards of their favorite stuff. And even if it's trading cards, like, they'll make a board and share it. And that pops on Google's images quite often. So another good one to have. But the trick is, if you put stuff in something like a Discord, you need to also have that publicly accessible, or else all that information you put in there is only going to be advertising to your existing audience. So if you don't also kind of mirror it to your website or in an email blast through something like MailChimp, then it's just lost. And 90% of your user base is in the dark about everything you've talked about for the past 3 months. So it's really a balance, honestly.
And so that brings up an interesting point, because, you know, personally, I've struggled a lot with, you know, kind of understanding the ways in people go about building a Patreon, right? Or, and as you said, you know, if you're a paid Patreon and you're paying this, you know, monthly tier, you're getting access to certain information, whether that's like releases or art or, you know, discussions in general. And so I'm curious, between something like a Patreon and a Discord, where you have a lot of those collaborative efforts and a lot of those types of things, where do you kind of draw the line between the information that you share to people that are just on a Discord versus your Patreon supporters who are, you know, paying you money to be a part of this exclusive community and hopefully get value out of that?
In the past, it's always been a physical item for me, or maybe additional added value digital items. I think that's the wrong way to use Patreon, because their shipping infrastructure is not established. Like, at one point I was talking with their head of like development over in the UK and helping them through a plan of how to integrate shipping. So if you want to ship products through Patreon, don't. Just use a Shopify. It's so bad. But now Discord has paid memberships too, so you can have like that paid gate on either one. And I think one thing we've done in the past is made like really, really high quality, like 6K resolution phone and desktop wallpapers of our characters. Or maybe we've given people sneak peeks at set development that the general public wouldn't want to know until the set comes out. And there's kind of that tease of how much do you share before a major set is released to kind of keep the buzz going. The trade-off for kind of hiding that behind a paywall is people could just take that and post it somewhere that you're not looking. And I guess that's fine. The thing for me is I would still be inclined to try it, because not everybody wants to know every spoiler. They just kind of want to get to the end. But like day-to-day work, I can't post most of what I'm doing now, which is weird. I used to be able to post every day and like, here's what I'm doing, check it out. But now I'm like, okay, I'm working on this thing you guys are going to maybe see in 8 months. And like, who wants to know that now, because it could change? So maybe a paid look in would help people up and coming. I've considered that back and forth. I asked the community a while ago and they said, nah, just keep it all public. But there's still that niche market, it'd be small, that want to know kind of the daily operations and seeing how things are going on the inside. And yeah, there's, I think, a purpose for that somewhere out there.
Gotcha. And in regards to Patreon and like you said, even some of the paid Discord roles and things like that, you know, you're saying that there's, you know, physical products that you can send out. You mentioned making the wallpapers and things like that. Is there, you know, in your projects, has there been any kind of, you know, tiered system where, you know, that kind of came into playtesters being kind of in certain groups versus others, you know, earlier groups of playtesters versus more public playtesting. So does some of that fit into, you know, the two different platforms?
So far for playtesting, we've kept it pretty close, like inner circle type stuff. And really, it's been a matter of seeing the community develop and noticing the frequency at which certain people talk and just kind of learning about them through the internet and through their ways of conversation with other people. And then just kind of picking the ones that feel best equipped to handle sensitive information. I mean, we've used like what would be like non-disclosures before, but I typically don't like to do that if I don't have to. Like, I'll just kind of make friends with people in the community and be like, okay, hey, we're going to have you test it out. And then beyond just trusting them, you obviously redact some of the information on the card. You don't give them a print ready looking file. You just kind of give them the playable card version of it. But yeah, as far as playtesting, do it early. I wouldn't necessarily hide it behind a paywall because you're going to want as much research as you possibly can. Even when you release it, people will still be playtesting it. And you might discover stuff that's broken after release. Be like, ah, crap, I should have caught that earlier. So the more people you can reasonably trust to playtest earlier and more often, better.
Mm-hmm. And so let's, you know, thinking about that, we're at a point where people, you know, want to play your game, right? Because that's part of the reason they're following. At least we'd hope, right? You know, most of the people want to play a trading card game for the game.
Yeah.
We know that that's kind of generally what we're shooting for. But so you have kind of a community of, you know, play testers, people who are interested in bouncing ideas back and forth. So in terms of strategies to grow the communities that you already have, right? You have those people who are initially interested, who have taken the time to join the Discord and enter those discussions. What kind of things do you do to grow, you know, an audience on Discord for people who want to do a lot of back and forth versus an audience on like Instagram who just want to stay tuned into that information that's coming out?
So it is a different strategy. I think on Discord, because it's a closed platform, you really have to incentivize people to invite or talk to their friends. And it's like, hey, I heard about this cool thing. Come on in. You could run paid campaigns, but nobody's going to join a Discord to start. They're always going to see what you're about somewhere else first. And I think as far as that goes, like building up your social media to have bigger numbers and collaborating with people, probably even doing some paid posts, honestly, is the best way. And consistent posting, that's something that I also struggle with because I'm working on stuff that's so far in the future that when I'm posting stuff now on set two, it's already stuff I've created 6 months ago that I'm now working on stuff 6 months from now. But it's like new-ish to people, and it's a weird mental space. So if you can, hire out, because as a creator, it's really weird posting new information that's not remotely new to you anymore and like having the same enthusiasm you did when you made it. But consistent posting will make every social media audience happy. And lately, it's been a lot of making resources for me. So if I'm not able to connect with new players or if my social medias don't fill in the gaps that people are looking for, I want some resource out there that can essentially answer every question they have. Be like, oh, how do I play Nostalgics? How do I collect it? What should I know if I'm a collector? What if I'm a game store and I want to like buy the product and, you know, host my own events? What's the cost to me? What do I do with this? So I've been trying to make a lot of that on the back end on the website. And then also kind of building out the lore and putting character development into that. We've even thought about like art books or behind the scenes on how we make the cards and the art. But the more resources and the more information you have out there, the better. User-generated content is also huge. So getting a good hashtag for your game and having people use that anytime they open it or play it or talk about it, it's also really valuable.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned hashtags earlier. And I know this kind of gets into the marketing bit, but you know, to your point, that's they're kind of part of the same area, you know. Building your community is, you know, marketing, right? Word of mouth and all that stuff. So with hashtags, I mean, they've been around since, I forget who introduced them. Twitter was the main.
I think it might've been, or like maybe even Tumblr at some point.
Yeah. And I just remember hearing about it like 15 years ago or something like that. But, you know, it's just like hashtags, what? But how effective are hashtags still with kind of tagging and finding content nowadays versus, just kind of regularly searching or using SEO to kind of have those things pop up.
So I don't claim to know all of Instagram's inner workings, but from what I have heard, there are hidden tricks where if you just use all these hashtags, say even if I do hashtag Hearthstone because our game has similar play mechanics to it, then that means that post will show up for hashtag Hearthstone. But if people are scrolling any kind of Hearthstone content that is generated from their interest in category Hearthstone according to Meta, and they see my post and they don't engage with it, it's going to drop it lower in the ranking for that. And that's going to affect the entire post as a whole. So if you're posting about Apple, the fruit, and you do hashtag Apple and people are looking for MacBooks and they don't click your beautiful picture of an Apple shot on a Samsung, your post is going to not get any traction because it's not what people are looking for. So like you can try to cross promote all you want and use hashtag Nostalgics, hashtag MetaZoo, hashtag Acora, all the indie games. But if people don't click your post, you're just shooting yourself. Like, I mean, it's not going to show up. So I think in a way it's good to do your own hashtags in there and kind of keep them organized. So people are interested in your topic, more of your posts will show up to them. But as far as getting in front of people that aren't typically your fans, that might have to come through collaboration nowadays, unless you have a really compelling post. Because if you're using other people's hashtags or trying to get beyond the box, your rank on that and your engagement with those people interested in that category is going to affect your overall post ranking behind the scenes. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You really have to be suave with Instagram and know the ins and outs to do remotely well on there. So if a post randomly goes viral, it's kind of not a mistake. It's just you happened upon the vein that is the algorithm.
Right. Exactly. And yeah, so I know most platforms have, you know, kind of their own version of like retweeting, right? So how effective is it, you know, when you're building your community and you're getting more followers and more people have eyes on your project, when people want to share what you're posting or you know, what you're saying, how much of that plays into community growth in general? You know, how much of that would you say affects, you know, how many people are joining your project versus the people who would otherwise just do it from directly seeing your posts?
I think story shares on Instagram are really nice. And even though they only last a day, I think it's a good look into somebody's day and their interests. So if I do a post and somebody shares it to their wall and they add some extra part of conversation to it, that's traditionally been really helpful for me. A tweet might hit a person's audience, but it's not too big of an impact, unless the creator is obviously massive. If I get a retweet from like, you know, Leon Hart or Elon Musk himself, like that's obviously going to help. But it really comes down to what's the account, what's their engagement, and end of the day, I suppose it doesn't hurt to get retweets or story shares. Facebook, I don't really think there's too much of that. There's like sharing to your wall, but businesses don't seem to do that. So the more you can get, the better. There's not really a downside to it. So if you're going to have a giveaway, definitely include it in the rules.
For sure. And so, you know, you mentioned consistent posting. You know, making sure content's coming out on a regular basis so that you know, people feel like there's a value in following the project and being part of that community. What other kind of incentives can you provide, you know, aside from Patreon and paid incentives and things like that, aside from just content, what other kind of incentives can you provide for a community? You know, maybe in terms of just, I know there's like news, you know, things that can go out in an email blast and things like that. But other ways that you can get people involved other than just content.
I think free product, if you get to that point, is always an option. And we've done sales every once in a while where we make a doorbuster where it's a free item. And people have kind of gotten used to that. So anytime we have a major sale, they quickly hop onto the announcements and they know that one of the items is going to be 100% free, you know, minus shipping, and they just have to be one of the first ones to get to it. So it's kind of getting that loyal base established and finding ways to make people want to pay attention to your announcements. So on Kickstarter, when we were doing updates on there, we would always end it with a teaser of the next post or the next set or something they've never seen before. And just, it gave them a reason to come back and kind of see what we were up to. But as far as emails and stuff, like once you get a shop and you get physical products, sales are always enticing. If you can't, you know, entice them with content and entertainment value, you can always give them educational value and say, you know, here's deck building tips, kind of find the pressure points in the community, or tell them how to use their cards in a new way. So, you know, an indie card game kind of lives and dies by its community. And usually that's a pretty spread out group, which is hard to overcome. So a lot of people need an opponent to play the game. But if you have a single player version of your game, maybe you battle your collection, you'd want to tell your audience that, because that allows them to kind of fight their own battles without having to get a whole group of people together to play with. So it just kind of expands the life of the product and gives them more resources, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so we have, you know, we have this whole idea of kind of collaboration, where on these platforms, you have these communities that are built off of just kind of making these genuine connections with people and things like that. And it kind of brings up the point of, you know, content creators and content creation outside of whatever you're creating. So where's the balance with that? Where do you, you know, how much of it is, you know, at this point, let's say, with where Nostalgics is at right now, how much of it is reaching out to content creators? And how much of it is content creators contacting you because they want to, you know, talk more about your product because they're, you know, fans of what's going on?
Yeah, it's a bit 50-50, honestly. I've got pretty good relationships with the content creators I worked with on the custom card side. The trick being that, like, while I can reach out to Super Duper Danny, Real Breaking Nate, Lean Heart, or Unlisted Leaf at any time, and they'd probably reply, it's finding a way to integrate it with their existing content schedule. Like, I'm really cognizant that an indie card game is harder to promote inside of a Pokemon video than just more Pokemon stuff. So it's really been like trying to strategize how that would function. You know, maybe opening up a pack of each and seeing which one you got a better card out of, or maybe doing an actual sponsored bit to just introduce the community to the idea and then starting to do a dedicated video. But there's been a bit of that. And then smaller creators, we've also done custom cards for, where we straight up hire one of our artists internally to make them a card of themselves kind of caricaturized with a Nostalgics character. And that's been really fun to do. And then print those, send them to the creators. We've worked with like Dobbs on YouTube, who has 1 million+ subscribers. We've worked with other game creators. We've worked with graphic novel creators. And it's just been really cool to see those come to life. And they share them on Twitter and Facebook, of course. They've got their own custom cards, and they can give those away to their community, which just further expands the brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. And so, and obviously the big goal with, you know, a lot of independent projects with, you know, especially with trading card games, unless you just come in it with a boatload of money, which is never usually the case.
Yeah.
you know, eventually we want to get to crowdfunding, right? Way back, I mean, it still happens today, but, you know, the more classic route was you have to convince a handful of investors to, you know, that not only was your product good, but your business plans were good and things like that. But now a lot of people rely pretty much completely on crowdfunding and things like that. So aside from wanting to get people to come in and crowdfund, right, what are some of the more, you know, key metrics that you use to see that you have like a healthy and active community? You know, something, you know, do you see dips every now and then? Do you see big spikes? And, you know, when do those things happen?
So we've noticed that around convention times, we see spikes, like new people jump into the servers and we talk to them in person, do a gameplay demo, and almost anybody we've shown a gameplay demo to has loved it, picked up a product, went home, and got into the community. So for us, that's been a good pat on the back to be like, hey, you have a good core design. You just need it in front of more people. And I think in this day and age, you actually have to physically play the game to be like, okay, I love it. You know, if you don't play it in person, you're going to maybe play it on tabletop sim, but that's a way greater barrier of entry. So a good metric to me is not necessarily the numbers of followers on social media, but it's the engagement of how many people are actually talking about it. And we can track it through some of our organized play software like Engem. We have a Nostalgics game event manager. And through that, I'm able to see on the back end how many stores are carrying the product and how many are hosting events, how many players are participating in the events. And that's been a big focus internally, is like growing that pool of stores and growing that cadence of events. so that people are seeing our name out there more often and more players are able to do that first game in person. Because I think getting a digital conversion is fine, but a physical conversion is like 10x better than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And that's a good point because, you know, we're talking about community from the aspect of, you know, we've mainly been talking about digital, like Facebook and Discord in terms of building a community. But, you know, we've touched on LGSs a few times in this conversation. What are some of the things that you do strategy wise, and places that you kind of spend your time, to build those physical presences in local game stores and, you know, getting those conversions at conventions and things like that?
Yeah. So a big part of it has been finding relevant conventions, and we've tried a few different avenues. We've done, you know, the Collecticons, which seems like a good fit. We've done the larger conventions like Origins Game Fair and now Gen Con coming up next week, which is going to have 70,000 attendees. And I've gone there as a just random attendee as well. And it's shoulder to shoulder the entire time. It's a really good convention. But we've also done smaller ones like Minnesota Card Show, which ended up being more like sports collectors and, you know, 40-year-old dads with their locked briefcase and the baseball cards inside and the kid kind of like hustling people. And it was a really interesting vibe, but a good experience to see, you know, in this kind of isolated instance, how well does a TCG do? And we still got some interest, but most of them were there for trading cards or sports cards. But we've noticed that a more generalized audience is a better fit for us. So if we went to like an anime con, they might like the art more because a lot of people are there to just kind of support local artists and make friends that like anime. But yeah, it's like the collector market and the art market is a totally different one in that regard. And then you have things like TCGCon where it's mostly players. So finding out where your base pillar is and then just like growing that, but also getting the other pillars to kind of reach that level is a balance. And of course, every time you go to a convention, it costs a lot of money. So you have to also be profitable or at least, you know, break even on a show. Beyond that, we've done road trips. We've done kind of referral plans. I want to build out a better method of that, but I want to essentially weaponize my community and have them be able to walk into an LGS and be like, hey, I know Nostalgics. I should teach my local game store about it so I don't have to be in 3,000 stores at once. We can, you know, have our community be the salesman for the game and then maybe they get a kickback for every store they convert. That'd be a massively helpful way to grow the community fast.
Gotcha. Awesome. Yeah. And I've heard a lot of programs like that where, you know, people who go to conventions and teach the game and play test it with people who are there, get kind of rewarded with certain things, or maybe they get early release, you know, things like that. So yeah. And again, this all kind of fits into, you know, community building is kind of inherently marketing in terms of what you're putting out there and then word of mouth and stuff like that. So aside from some of the more, so everything we've talked about so far and some of the more obvious points of building a community, such as, you know, just getting your stuff out there and all that, what are there, is there anything that you could tell someone who is, you know, just starting, they're clutching their baby, right? They're like, I have this thing, I have this idea and I don't want to share it with anybody, but I have to, you know, what kind of advice would you give them, in terms of, you know, getting that community going?
I think you really do need to have friends at the end of the day. And if you're not the people person that can present it, find somebody who is and then kind of partner with them. So if you're more of the creative shy type and you're not good presenting online, either utilize AI to find a good way to speak to people or even like use an avatar, so to speak, where you kind of mocap into something, or, you know, you see VTubers all over the place, and that's been a great resource for people that don't want to, you know, share their own face on the internet, but find a way to get in front of people. Usually if it's a good work, it'll speak for itself. I mean, I've gone years just posting cards that I've made and it grew. So you don't have to share yourself. If you don't want to, you could just kind of share what you make. But at the end of the day, you just have to have a good product and put it in front of people and make it enticing. Make it rewarding for somebody to follow. Everybody follows Pokemon at this point. I mean, it's the biggest IP that's ever existed. So you kind of know what they like, and people like Magic, and you hear the pressure points of where different card games are. So just kind of learn the lessons other companies have paid millions of dollars to learn and don't do them. And you know, anybody that's liking your posts or liking an account that you follow, I think they're more qualified to be your friend than the average person on the street. Like, you've got something in common with these people. And at the end of the day, that's kind of what it's all about. You're in a community to like the same thing. And if you found a random person on the street that liked the same game you did, you'd be like, oh my gosh, friend, you have to add me on Facebook or do something with me. Like, why isn't it the same online? You know, there's so many people out there that are just like you. And I don't know, a while ago, it wasn't like that. You know, we'd see movies in the theater that didn't really relate to what we liked. And now freaking everything is a superhero movie. So clearly there's a lot more nerds out there than we expected.
yeah, for sure. All right. So we've touched on, you know, digital platforms, in-person events, kind of how marketing plays into things, and, you know, kind of how, you know, it some of this content is with it being behind like a paywall or in like a private group versus something that's public facing. And all of this is tied together to kind of, you know, to a lot of good advice on how to build a community and to keep a strong community. But I think the core message here is that you need to be genuine, right? You need to come at it from a place of, hey, I'm not trying to build this community from a perspective of like, eventually I want to sell this to you, but you being genuinely interested in what I'm doing makes it better for everybody. And I think that's the core of it. Have you seen any examples of maybe communities that have been built up, and we don't have to drop names or anything like that, but communities that have been built up that were not based off of, you know, being genuine and wanting to build those kinds of relationships? And can you kind of go over some of the things that you saw that caused those communities to either diminish or crumble or just kind of stagnate over time?
So I think transparency and honesty is a big part of it. And like, don't join the trading card game industry because you think you're going to make money. Like, I have spent so much money making this card game, regardless of what the Kickstarter numbers say, like, no, that's not the amount of money you get as a creator from this. And, I mean, at this point we've spent all the Kickstarter money on the game and we're beyond that part. We're just kind of surviving off the sales of it. But at the end of the day, as long as it's profitable, I'm going to keep creating it. And there's other creators that haven't gone that route. And that's kind of been difficult to see on Kickstarter. There's creators that start a project with limited amount of information and then shortly realize that printing or logistics are far too much than they expected. And they're not able to deliver. And that essentially hurts the entire industry by shaking morale, if that's even possible to launch a game at a certain budget. There's been creators that have like actually physically passed away, and that's crippled a community. There was no game plan, and then you later realize that behind the scenes there was issues anyway. And that's not just indies too. You know, if you go into something for just money, then one day you might wake up with a zoo full of NFTs that mean nothing. And I think that's pointed enough to kind of tell you, like, if your past works don't speak for your future works, you know, yeah, just look at people's past. People can change, obviously. I think there's a little bit too much what you said on Twitter 10 years ago is who you are today. And people do evolve and grow. But if it's a repeat thing, you should probably be a little leery of where a person's at before you invest thousands of dollars into somebody's project. But kind of beyond that, though, if you do invest thousands into somebody's project and it's not going the way you want it to, I think the thing to realize is that as a backer of a campaign, you have the direct ability to help it grow. Every person you tell, every person your friend tells about the game makes it grow. So that helps your investment mature if you're into that type of thing. I've always been into find a character I like, find an art style I like, and collect that. Like, I have the most drowsy, I think it's 76 from Breakpoint of anybody on the planet. 56 or 76, yeah. It's just this drowsy, looks really happy on a card. Utterly worthless. It's like a common, maybe 50 cents on TCG player. But I just liked it, so I now have 700 of them. For no reason. Like, that's the kind of collector item. I pick something and I dig it. But I think it's easier to hate on a game than to actually help it succeed. If you see something not working, share it or like give your feedback in a constructive way. Everybody's listening. I think creators are the hardest on themselves, and we typically see the issues before our community points it out. We just have to kind of live with what happened. But promoting the game is, at the end of the day, the best you can do as a community.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, speaking of promoting a game, you said hey, that you were, so, you know, you had just mentioned that Nostalgics is just released or about to release its second set. So go into a little bit about Nostalgics as a game, but also just kind of as a as an intellectual property, just as a thing, right? Because like you said, there's the art, there's the lore and things like that. So kind of for people who aren't aware of Nostalgics, kind of give us a little slightly longer than an elevator pitch of like what this game is.
So it came from the idea of we were making custom cards and we wanted to be able to fuse all these properties we were making customs for into one game. So how do you fuse everything that Yu-Gi-Oh! Stands for, which has evolved into a lot more than I would expect nowadays, and Pokemon, maybe even like a Digimon. I was on some Skype chat with a coworker ages ago, and I was like, you know, I want to make this game where hypothetically a Rick and Morty type character could be riding a Charizard using like Excalibur against somebody else with a Frost Sword. And I was like, just, you know, fuse everything together. How do I pull that off? And then we got into, okay, how does this actually look? So we had to break all the characters in existence into as few different elemental types as possible. And we ended up with 8. So we've got light, dark, earth, fire, water, mystic, and neutral. And neutral is kind of the catch-all, but there's surprisingly little that ends up being in neutral. It was harder to figure out a neutral character than it was to not. And from that, we discovered, okay, there's our fighter pool. Now we need equipment so you can actually put things on fighters. You need arenas that can change the arena they're playing in. Spell cards, because every game has it, and you need some kind of quick activation. And then heroes, which would be you in this instance. You can use a hero from our world, or you can actually make your own custom card, and you can be the hero in Nostalgics. So because you never shuffle the hero card, it's proxyable. You can use a 3D printed model, a post-it note on a Fiji water bottle. Like, I don't care. As long as you have the ability and the health written on it, you're good. Just proxy card that we printed. But gameplay-wise, it ends up being a fusion of Hearthstone meets Pokemon. You've got fighters that can evolve over time, and you've got a hero behind the scenes that is kind of directing it all. And you can win one of two ways. Either defeat 10 of your opponent's fighters, who evolve, or defeat your opponent's hero. And along the way, you can equip your hero or your fighters to buff them up. You can activate spells. You can change the arena and the rules of the game. And you can play surprises, which are kind of like a trap card from Yu-Gi-Oh! To, you know, counter your opponent's effects and try to win the game in a creative way. But yeah, all that to say, like, we take pop culture references and fuse like at least two of them together into a new creative way. Like, how would an Agumon and a Pikachu fuse together look? Is there a core element that, you know, holds them together and makes them popular for each of those games? Is it just because they're yellowish? You know, like, you just gotta find that core commonality and make a new character in that vein. That's really what we aim to do.
Nice. And so is there kind of a general storyline that you guys try to follow, or is it kind of just you kind of release tidbits of lore and kind of explanations as you go?
So there is a lore. We've got basically two different time zones. There's a character that was born at the same time as another character, and because of this, they end up being like entwined at the soul. We call them soul brothers. And one day their village is attacked, and one of the two, named Corvus, activates this potion that usually protects the village, but he does it in a kind of corrupt way. And he opens this portal to the void, which is like another dimension. So Corvus is sucked into this dimension that's, you know, kind of out of sight, but like layered on Earth. And because his friend Shiga is able to feel all of his emotions and all of his, like, you know, pain or joy, then he can feel Corvus, but he can't see him. And it really like grates at this guy's mind. It's like a constant itch that you can't scratch. You have to find this other person that you can't find. So he chases these soldiers back to their home kingdom and kind of gets up the ranks of their army, discovers, you know, who was behind the attacks, and other stuff happens. He meets friends. We're actually working on a graphic novel for that entire portion of the story, but there's a whole element to that that makes the man basically go insane and realize that something's happening with the world as a whole and the cycle from which our lore is based on. There's like a world element going on that loops in a way that I haven't seen before in pop culture, which is kind of fun. And he discovers that and kind of has a motivation for being, in other people's eyes, evil. And another element is that each character in our world is born with an ale, like A-E-L, on the back of their neck. And that gives them the ability to be proficient in a certain type of magic. And if you had like a water one, you could have, you know, proficiency in water, but you could also use fire if you wanted to. However, if you use fire, it's weaker. And if you go too far using an element that you're not born with, you kind of like lose your humanity and turn into a shadow. So you're able to protect yourself with anything, but you might, you know, turn into a beast at some point. And yeah, so we're building up the lore a lot more now. Each hero in our game is part of our continent, Nostoram, and they'll have different intermatching stories on our website. Each of the characters is a various stage of intelligence, and that's been a really hard thing to figure out too. Like in Pokemon, everybody just says their name unless they're Meowth. But in our game, like, which characters should be able to speak, you know, intellectual language and which ones can't? Like, should a beetle be able to speak? Probably not. But should this humanoid looking thing be able to telepathically like talk to people? Maybe it should. And we've had a lot of exploration on that part. And, you know, which ones are one-off characters like this god tree in a forest and which ones are everywhere like these little tiny magnets that fuse together. So it's been a good thought process. And I think we're at a very solid point right now. We actually just got to present the graphic novel to a studio in Japan, and they're very interested. So we're proceeding on that right now with the part one story draft. But yeah, there's world building is really fun. It's probably one of the best parts of the day when I get to work on that stuff. Doing the card templates is fun, but like sitting in Photoshop for 12 hours, it used to be a lot easier. Now I'm just like, oh my gosh, standing desk, help me out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that sounds awesome. You know, and for anybody who wants to learn more, including myself, because, you know, I'm wanting to know
kind of what happens
with all this stuff. You know, where can they follow Nostalgics, and where can they find, you know, the most of the content and contact you and get in touch with you if they need to?
Yeah. So the best one is just nostalgicstcg.com. So Nostalgics ends in X because we wanted it to be referential to the 90s where everybody's usernames ended in X's. kind of fun. But then, yeah, NostalgicsTCG.com has all the resources, the stories. The press releases on there are just like major announcements. But if you want the most up-to-date, it's got links to our Discord and Instagram on there. Those are the best spots to hit us up. We're always doing something on there. In Discord, I'm active like multiple times a day. So if you ever want to DM me, always open, always looking for ideas and new players to learn the game and teach others and just explore with us what this could be.
Awesome. Well, Hunter, I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing, you know, a lot of these tips and ideas about how to grow a community. You know, it's worth pointing out that if you want to see a healthy community in action, go ahead and join the Discord for Nostalgics. You can, you know, see kind of how those things operate and maybe get some ideas for, you know, what people look for when they join a community and some of the things they talk about. It's obviously a really big subject, but it's really important. And like I said, I appreciate your time coming on. And yeah, I hope everything goes well with that second set and, of course, beyond, since that's what you're working on.
Yeah, set two just launched last month. Set three's in the works right now. And obviously the graphic novel is going to really expand the lore of our game and hopefully give people more of those instances like you mentioned with Pokemon. They want to collect Charizard because he was cool in the anime and cool in the game. So let's find a way to make Nostalgics characters have the same push for players. But I appreciate being on here. Thanks so much. And yeah, I hope you guys check it out. It's a really fun game. And if you're looking for something new to play and kind of a respite from what you're used to, stop on over. We'd love to have you.
All right. Thanks, Hunter.
Thank you.
All right. So that was Hunter Angel, the creator of the Nostalgics TCG, talking about how to build a community, whether you're bringing in a already existing community into your project space or trying to build one up from scratch. And I think we got a lot of good examples about how to build a community and do that sort of outreach on digital platforms, as well as in person, like in, you know, local game stores and also conventions. So, you know, I think that building community is obviously important, but I think the core of the message there was to be genuine and to look at forming real relationships with people. That way, that community is just that much stronger. You know, 100 followers who are passionate about your project and are really interesting in what you're doing is going to be a lot better than 10,000, you know, random followers who couldn't care less. So if you enjoyed the episode, please consider supporting the channel by checking out some of our sponsor links in the description below, or in the notes of the podcast. And if you want to find out more about what we've got going on in the TCG design space or the TCG space in general, you can visit us at theboosterpacknetwork.com. You can also find us on our social media handles at TBPNcontent, and you can reach out to me directly if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes. My email is j@theboosterpacknetwork.com. All right. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and I'll see you next time.